UK Wine Show, show number 201. Brendan O'Toole from Summergate Wines on the Chinese wine market. Good day to you all. My name's Chris Scott and welcome to the UK Wine Show, the UK's finest and longest running podcast. This week I'm recording the show black and old blighty after spending nearly 4 weeks globe-trotting around the world. Hong Kong, Australia, New Zealand, New York. What a busy trip I've had. But it's great to get back to the old UK. I miss the weather and the rain, the wind and the snow. Not. But I did miss my girls. And for those of you who've been missing Jane's luscious tones on the news, we have her back this week as well. The spotlight this week is looking at the poll, How Confident You Are in Choosing Wines. And the interview this week is with Brendan O'Toole. He's a Kiwi living in Hong Kong. And along with his American business partner, Ian Ford, they set up Summergate Wines, one of China's largest, if not the largest, wholesaler in China. We chat about the Chinese consumer and the wine market. And finally this week, we have our mystery grape variety. Now, as normal, I'm going to give you two sets of clues, one now and just one before the interview. And then I'll give you the answer with both clues again after the interview. So have we listened to this and see if you can work it out. Our mystery grape variety is a pink-skinned variety that produces headily-scented and full-bodied white wines. It's cultivated in most parts of the globe, although it's mainly grown in Alsace in France, where it's designated a noble grape variety. Its origins are Italian. It was first noted in the village of Tramin or Tramino in what is now known as Italy's Troil, in the region known as Alto Adige. It is a relatively low and erratic yielder, although the Germans have developed some higher-yielding clones. It's exceedingly prone to a variety of viruses, and it suffers from spring frost because it leaves early. That doesn't mean it leaves. It breaks out and leaves quite early on. It ripens quite early too, and is always harvested before Riesling. But it's a good quality grape, and one that is making a reputation for itself for food and wine, being that it goes particularly well with Thai and Chinese cooking. While our mystery grape grows in many cool regions of the world, it is not grown in Bordeaux, and that's where a lot of this week's news is coming from. So next up, we have the news read this week, luckily, for those who are missing it, by Jane.
Thanks, Chris. Second growth Chateau Montrose has purchased 22 hectares of vines from neighbour Chateau Falansagur, a former Cru Bourgeois Exceptionnel from the now defunct 2003 classification. Owner and billionaire Martin Boug has bought plots of Merlot, Cabernet Sauvignon and Cabernet Franc, increasing the Montrose estate from 67 hectares to 89. According to director Jean Delmar, the plot was once part of Montrose until the end of the 19th century. He says the terroir is superb on the top of Montrose Hill, and next year it's hoped the grapes will be included in both the first and second wines.
In Bordeaux, they always talk about terroir, but class growths are not limited by a particular terroir, soil, climate. You don't need these to make class growths, unlike in Burgundy, where the vineyard is king. The name is king in Bordeaux. So once unclassed vineyards can easily become premier cru or second growth if purchased by a domain with the correct credentials by simply adding the wine to the blend and increasing the volume produced. In this case, the wine that was not particularly expensive can now become a second growth. A fantastic way of improving the profitability of your vineyard. What's the next story, Jane?
Well, another billionaire, this time wine collector William Koch, has filed another lawsuit against Christie's, claiming the auction house ignored evidence of fakery in the 1980s when it sold wines that were supposedly once owned by American President Thomas Jefferson, but that are now believed to be counterfeit. The suit is the latest to be filed by Koch over the collection in 4 years. Christie's deny the charges.
According to the book The Billionaire's Vinegar, which describes this whole sorry, sad affair, Christie's had carried out some fairly decent testing before the wines went up on sales. With Michael Broadbent standing behind them saying that they were the genuine article, it's not unusual for someone like Koch to believe it. However, no one knew where Rodenstock, the person who sold the wines, never admitted where he found the wines or where he got them from, so there was always been a bit of doubt about that. What bothered me when I read the book was that Christie's, at the time of writing, had not released a second report looking at the engravings on the bottle. The first report, written by Christie's glass experts looking at the bottles, had said they were genuine. but subsequent independent testing had shown that the engravings on the bottles had actually been made with an electric engraver, which didn't exist in 1700s when the bottle was supposed to be produced. Christie's re-examined the etchings, but refused to release the second report on this. I don't know why the reasons why Coke is going after Christie's. I suspect it's because he can't get at Rodenstock, the person who created the fakes in the first place. But Coke does come across as a particularly rich, resourceful and resentful person about being ripped off. And he's run many a court case over multiple years to get revenge on people. So I imagine that Christie's perhaps regret selling him the fakes. Do get the book Billionaire's Vinegar. It's an excellent book, if somewhat banned in the UK. What's the last story about Bordeaux, Jane?
Well, the 2009 Bordeaux vintage, heralded as the vintage of the century by some, surpassing 2005, has been unveiled at this week's En Primaire tastings, and many reports suggest it's living up to their expectations. According to decanter wine critic Stephen Spurrier, after his first full day of tasting, Bordeaux has made a quantum leap and produced a truly modern vintage, the best that Bordeaux have ever produced. Spurrier had only tasted the Right Bank and the Cru Bourgeois of the Medoc, but Hong Kong critic Jeannie Sholi, MW, described three of the first five growths as stunning wines with amazing density. But some think 09 might not be quite on a par with 05. For example, French blogger Jean-Marc Quarin suggests the 2009 may not have the balance and freshness of the 05. And Christian Mouet of Petrus said that 2009 had been a vintage that demanded time and money to get right. Other reports question the ageing potential of the wines compared with 2005, given that many of the wines are drinking well now from the 09 vintage. Meanwhile, Sauternes and Barzac were singled out as great vintages across the board by French journalist Michel Bertin. That's it from me this week, but don't forget to go to our website 3050.co.uk to check out these stories.
Cheers, Jane. 2009 sounds like a great vintage. So far, we're up to, what, two or three vintages of the century? I think it's three vintages of the century so far. Either way, pricing is going to be a bit of a concern for some buffs. Gary Vaynerchuk in the US has stated he's sitting this one out. And given what we're learning about China, the loss of American market doesn't seem too much of a problem for those trophy collectors collecting the first growths. I think it's going to be the second and third growths pricing that's going to be really interesting this year, especially when the likes of Christian Mollier say that the vintage can be good, but it costs a lot of time and effort and money in the vineyard. So lower class growths may find things a bit mixed. One of the reasons China is going to buy Bordeaux is because it's important for them to show face or respect to other people. The other, as Brendan's going to say in the interview, is because they're not as confident about choosing wines. And we'll find out about that in the interview, which is coming up soon. But next up, we have the Spotlight, which we ran in February. And the question was, how confident are you when it comes to choosing wine? Now, I know this poll was run in February. With all my travels and that, I forgot to actually slot it in the Spotlight as I was traveling around. So let's have a look at the results from our poll. How confident are you when it comes to choosing wine? The results are, and I'm going to compare them to February 2010 with January 2008, where we asked the same question. Totally at ease. I know my way around most wine labels. 6% in February 2010 said that. 29% in January 2008. Most of the time, I'm comfortable but could do with knowing more. 43% in February 2010. 34% in January 2008. I get by, although I wish wine was easier to understand. 36% in February 2010 and 20% in January 2008. Not at all confident. I stick with what I know or leave it to someone else to decide. 15% in February 10 and 17% in January 08. Now, while we originally asked this question back in January 08, I was always surprised by the results given the number of people who felt at ease with wine. But with a much larger sample, this time we had 276 people respond to the questionnaire as opposed to 89 in January 08. A more expected result, I think, is curd. Luckily, only 15% weren't confident with wine. Thankfully, that means that 85% can get by and pick the wine they want. Confidence is a state of mind. I'm confident when I choose wine, not because I know every wine on the list and how those wines will taste. It's far from it. But because I often pick a wine that I'm unsure of, simply because I like that mystery, I'm not too worried about it. In fact, I would almost go to say it's a bit of ignorance is bliss. I usually go for the wine I don't know about, and therefore I'm not worried about it if it doesn't taste good or bad because I'm just experimenting. And I think that confidence is about that state. If you're trying to get the perfect match with food or something like that, you're always, always going to be a bit disappointed if you don't know exactly what you're doing. Whereas if you look at it as, oh, it's a bit of an experimentation, something to get stuck into and try, then you can be confident picking. I don't know if that sounds particularly good, but that's the way I look at it anyway. This month's poll is the Scottish Government wants to set a minimum price for alcoholic drinks. Is this a good thing where you live? Do go to the website, log in and have your say. You can get to it by going to the ukwineshow.co.uk and then clicking on wine poll. And I think it's actually on the right-hand side on that page. You can actually just select the poll. Right, let's crack on with the show though. Let's get into this mystery variety. So here's the second clue in our mystery grape variety. Wines from this variety are generally made by high alcohol, often coupled with very low acidities, which means that cool climates do a lot of favours for this variety. Hence its success in countries such as Germany and Austria, and more recently New Zealand. I actually have a variety of this as a dessert wine from Cloudy Bay, which Siobhan the viticulturist gave me when I saw her. It's in the fridge, I might crack into it this Easter. Its naturally high sugar levels also make it ideal for making sweet, late harvest wines in sunny years, the best of which can last for decades. And our mystery grape variety is a mutation of the original Traminer grape variety, and one that is now the most planted variant. Smelling of lychees and rose petals are the typical characteristics often associated with it, or to me it can sometimes smell of Turkish delight, making it one of the easiest wines to distinguish if you're having a blind tasting. In fact, we use this wine in our blind tastings quite a bit because you either know it, in which case it's dead easy, or you don't know it and you've got no chance. I'll give you the answers to the mystery grape variety after the interview, which is coming up next, with Brendan O'Toole from Summergate Wines. Let's have a listen to what he has to say about the Chinese wine market. My name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Brendan O'Toole from Summergate Wines in Hong Kong. How are you, Brendan?
Very well, thank you very much, Chris.
Excellent. Summergate Wines, we're actually in Hong Kong at the moment for this interview, but you've got offices throughout China.
Yes, we do. In fact, we started the business 10 and a half years ago in mainland China with offices in Shanghai and Beijing initially, and soon followed up with further offices in the mainland in the south, in Shenzhen, then Guangzhou, and subsequently also have opened a few years ago in Macau, which has been very successful for us, and this time last year here in Hong Kong. We're now in the process of opening further offices in the mainland.
What exactly do you guys do?
Summergate is involved in importing and distributing bottled wines into all of Greater China. We also have retail sales as well that we've been developing. But the business so far has been primarily focused on importation distribution. We're one of only a couple of wine companies who actually service the entire mainland market directly, through our own offices, people, infrastructure, and so on, with a full sales and logistical service and full marketing and promotional activities behind wine across the entire length and breadth of mainland China. Also, I guess more uniquely, across all of Greater China with our presence in Hong Kong and Macau. And in fact, today we are the only wine company who have got fully fledged sales and marketing operations in all three territories, so across mainland China and in Macau and in Hong Kong.
Is Macau separate to Hong Kong? I always think of it as the same.
No, technically two different markets, the Hong Kong SAR or Special Administrative Region, and Macau is a SAR as well, and there are different regulatory structures, tax structures and the like, so they can be viewed as separate markets. Although having said that, increasingly all the markets are becoming substantially more integrated. There's a lot of trans-border commerce. That's just getting bigger and bigger. We've always had this view that the market should be viewed as one single market, that ultimately in the long term it will, in terms of geopolitical structure, be one single market. The Hong Kong SAR, the border will come down in about another 35 to 40 years' time, similarly for Macau. And then both Macau and Hong Kong will simply be other cities in China, as opposed to Hong Kong being viewed still at a certain level as an independent country. So a lot of our strategies, our investments in our business, the developments that we've been seeking to pursue, are with that long-term vision in mind of one market.
Okay, I had a look at your wine list that you've got, your brand portfolio list for Summergate, March 2009, it says, and it's quite a who's who of top producers. You know, you've got everything from Fountain Road in New Zealand right through to Ridge in the States and everything in between, you know, and quite a selection of pretty decent Burgundy and even the odd Bordeaux in there. How can you get such a good, solid portfolio together? There must be competition for those type of producers.
Certainly, bearing in mind when we started, I think, you know, in some ways you could say it's the simple old adage of being in the right place at the right time. The China market still today is very much in its infancy. But 10 years ago, 11 years ago, when we were starting, I think a lot of these brands were not in the mainland market. There was a window of time, an opportunity that was available to us and for companies who knew what they were looking for, to go out and approach high-class brands and to be able to assemble quality portfolios. I think we've paid particular attention to it. We've recognised the value in that, and we've gone and sought out manufacturers and wineries, brands with common values, with a long-term view, with a willingness to make a commitment to the to these markets. And people we think we can work with. This is something that we wouldn't have been able to do if we'd been seeking to create a new business from scratch in a mature market like North America or one of the European markets. But in the context of China, being in its infancy, you know, we were very fortunate to be in a position to be able to do that.
You just mentioned earlier about the special administration zones for Hong Kong and China. How important are things like duty to you? Because obviously Hong Kong has no duty, but China has quite high duty. Do you have to manage your business differently because of that, or how does that affect you at all?
It's all relative. It's about what, you know, what the you know, the overall market has to comply anyway, whatever those duty rates are. Certainly, the impacts of the duty rate reductions here in Hong Kong a couple of years ago have been substantial with respect to consumption in Hong Kong, and there's been a significant trading up and a significant increase in volume consumed here in Hong Kong. That's been a very, very good thing for the wine markets generally, but Hong Kong in particular. In the mainland, of course, we're still subjected to very, very high rates of tax on wine. Having said that, that hasn't really, you know, when you look at the growth curves and in the development of volumes flowing into China, it doesn't seem to be doing anything to dampen consumption, and the markets have been growing very aggressively throughout these last 10 years. But I think in terms of the relative differences between Hong Kong and Macau, which both now have zero import duties levied, versus the mainland, which has quite substantial import taxes levied.
What are the duties on the mainland?
It's quite complicated to describe it in simple terms, but I guess in effect you could say, I mean, you have import tax, there is a consumption tax, then there's VAT. There are various other forms of tax, including, for example, corporate income tax being one. When you roll it all up, you're probably talking about, if a bottle of wine sells in the mainland for 100 renminbi, you're probably talking about 35 renminbi or more being taxes in various shapes and forms. Import duties are levied. There's a formula where you can gross the number up. It's about 48% of the cost of goods as it arrives at the wharf in China is the import tax levied, which includes import tax and consumption tax and VAT all rolled together.
Yep. Okay, and then you put your...
And then you put margins on top, distributors' margins, retailers' margins, and then there's a final balance of VAT payable on the final sales price.
Okay. You sell wine to both restaurants and Is it the off-trade as well?
Yep, certainly. All trade buyers, restaurants and hotels have been a particularly important channel historically. Retail supermarkets, particularly the big international chains, have been expanding aggressively in China and have become increasingly a very important channel, and the off-trade is gradually gaining a bit of, a larger share of the overall pie. For us, as an importer and distributor, we very recently, it was only until very recently, started to develop sales to sub-distributors, and we're seeing tremendous growth now that we've embarked on that. So those sub-distributors give us a platform through which we can expand our coverage of geographical territories and channels within China. So that's it in very simple terms.
So you've almost got, what is it, two-tier system for distribution before it even gets to the retail outlet. So it's three tiers, isn't it?
Can be, yes, it can be.
Two or three.
Yes, and certainly an inland city such as Chengdu, for example, where we would import and potentially sell to a sub-distributor based in Chengdu who then on-sells to a hotel or a restaurant or a supermarket locally who sells to a final consumer.
What's the breakdown of sales, say, between off-trade, so someone going to a supermarket or a wine shop to purchase wine, versus sales for, say, a restaurant?
It's impossible to get an accurate hard number on that. We don't have the sorts of data that we have in a market such as the UK available in China. But I would estimate, based on all of our experience, our sales patterns, my sense of the overall market, that it's still heavily concentrated towards on-trade, restaurants, hotels, whether that's, four or five-star fine dining in or out of a hotel, or whether it's more kind of mid-tier Chinese restaurant sector, which is enormous, or the bar scene, the night scene. Roughly speaking, I would probably hazard a guess that about 60% of the volume is going through on-trade and about 40% off, which is almost a flip-flop of what it is in many mature markets.
Yeah.
Over time, I would expect things to trend more towards off-trade consumption as Chinese drinkers become more knowledgeable about wine and have more confidence in going to a supermarket or a wine shop to buy.
Who are these Chinese drinkers? Are they, 25-year-old kids or adults, sorry, or are they more mature businessmen? What's your classic Chinese drinker, and/or is there a profile that they fit?
I think you could give it a profile or a kind of a stereotypical Chinese drinker. You could describe one as between the ages of 25 to 45, 25 to 35, 25 to 45. That age group, both male and female. Females are an interesting category and quite a strong segment as well. They're typically young white collar Chinese. This emerging, increasingly affluent middle class, depending on which market research report you want to read, in aggregate you're talking about anything that could be from 100 million to 200 million plus of these people who do drink wine in China today. And by drink wine, they may be having a few glasses to several glasses per year per person, on average.
Glasses per year, so not bottles per week.
Not huge, but then that's an aggregate statement across that entire
category
or base of people. Within that, there's going to be lots of different segments, and you're going to have connoisseurs, you're going to have fine collectors. Although they may be very few in number, some of these people could be incredibly wealthy, and they're really hunting for trophy wines and wanting to build cellars, and we see a lot of that emerging now increasingly. But broadly speaking, you're talking about this emerging white-collar, middle-class Chinese. Usually it's a young husband-wife, working couple. They're starting to adopt and develop Western habits of living, seeking those sorts of lifestyles and have similar aspirations to people around the rest of the world. They want to have an apartment, live independently from their mothers or grandparents, which is something that's new for China. They may want to own a car, And they want to have a television and a stereo and all of these sorts of trappings and brands and lifestyle elements that, that people in other parts of the world would want to have. And wine fits right into that. Wine is something that helps them to express those lifestyle aspirations and to demonstrate success to their friends and colleagues. So
it's quite interesting when you look around the world, often where wine's sales are falling, like in France, the younger generation are moving away from wine because that's what their parents drink, whereas maybe because there's no history of wine, serious wine consumption in China, these people want to drink something different to what their parents drink now. What do their parents drink?
Well, China's had a tremendous history in and a tradition in drinking alcohol beverage, for thousands of years. And some of the biggest drinkers that I've ever encountered in my life are Chinese drinkers.
And you're a Kiwi, so...
they don't mess around. But more recently, the older generations would have been drinking white grain spirits such as Baijiu, white spirit, and high-strength alcohols. There was a period where cognac saw a tremendous boom, boom and bust, but it's certainly kind of recovered and is showing much more stable, solid growth trajectory now. I think through the early 70s and 80s, as China suddenly was developing wealth very rapidly in the hands of very few people, one of the ways in which people who were becoming rich fast would demonstrate their success was to go out and order the most expensive drink in the house. And that at the time happened to be cognac, and if not cognac, spirits. So there was a real surge in cognac and spirit consumption, which wasn't because they enjoyed those spirits, but it was because it was able, through that, they were able to demonstrate success, give face, show success, etc. So some of those sorts of factors were at play. But over time, short period of time, I guess, in the grand scheme of things, it became more a case that you could give or receive even more face and demonstrate greater success and sophistication by purchasing, for the same money, a Bordeaux first growth. And so there was a shift off high alcohol spirits to high qualities of wine, and we're still sort of working through that trend. At the same time as well, you had the government who were really promoting wine. There was a domestic industry that they were seeking to nurture and develop. There was a lot of pressure on grain crops in China, and the government was seeking to move consumption away from grain-based spirits to free up grain for staple food, and therefore the strive to encourage people to drink wine. Grape wine as an alternative, and mm-hmm. wine being much lower alcohol, a healthier drink. There were these things at work as well. So the government certainly gave it a big push and continue to do so. I guess, young people certainly less inclined to be wanting to drink high alcohol spirits, more health conscious. Perhaps there is a little bit of wanting to be not doing what their parents or grandparents used to do. But wine certainly very much being perceived as an international drink, a lifestyle drink, a healthy drink, and a drink that demonstrates a certain sort of quality and affluence and style of living mm-hmm. That fits with their aspirations.
I've spoken to a few people and I've seen some fantastic wine lists. They all look great. And then you pop into some of the shops and they've got things like Yellowtail, £10 a bottle, $100 Hong Kong dollars, which seems awfully high for that style of wine. It's almost like there's two different markets going on there. You've got this high-end, very aspirational drinking, but there's also still a wee bit of this low-end market. And what impressed me with your wine list was you seem to have the middle ground. What is the breakdown of consumption between, say, top-end sort of status wines, good quality wines for drinking, and then the gluggers at the bottom? Where is that spectrum?
It varies across the three markets. Hong Kong and Macau are quite premium markets relative to the mainland, and certainly wine importers and distributors have been around for roughly 20 years longer than they have in the mainland. The trade is substantially more evolved and developed, and you've got wine buyers, wine drinkers in Hong Kong and Macau who know their wines. You know, they're familiar with brands, they're familiar with wine styles, they appreciate quality a lot more, which is not to, you know, sort of look down on the mainland. The mainland's just a very new phenomenon. It's developing that understanding and appreciation very rapidly. But you also have tax structures which also put certain levels, certain grades of wine beyond the financial reach of wine drinkers too. So, but if I was to dig into Hong Kong, I mean, Hong Kong, there's consumption at all levels, and of course most of the volume is the entry level qualities, and you see in the supermarkets typically, as you would in the UK or Northern Europe, a range of wines that are going to be very familiar to you. Through the restaurant sector, where you see wines by glass at accessible price points that may or may not be also in the off trade, right through to very premium and super premium wines, and you've got a more sophisticated sort of hierarchy of segments of consumers, from collectors and connoisseurs all the way through to novice wine drinkers. Hong Kong is much more towards a UK style market. The mainland's a very, very nascent, embryonic market, however. And we see a lot of demand at the very top, particularly for things like Bordeaux first growths. But alongside that, as much as people in other parts of the world may revere fine Burgundy, the mainland, broadly speaking, isn't buying fine Burgundy yet, let alone fine Italian wines or fine Spanish wines or fine wines from other parts of the world, the New World. It's still very much, you know, this primary search for trophy wines or big brand wines, and the Bordeaux first growths are first out of the gate on that. And then at the other end of the spectrum, because the people in the mainland aren't yet confident when they reach for and buy wine, so off a wine list or off a retail shelf, they may buy a low-cost Bordeaux or a low-cost French wine, because there's still this kind of concept that fine wine comes from France, or fine, you know, a Bordeaux is a more recognised name. Mm-hmm. And other categories, such as Italy or Spain, are higher risk. They know less about them, and they're less willing to spend, you know, a significant sum of money on those sorts of wines. So the middle ground is somewhat lost in China, in fact. There's big volume at the bottom.
Who dominates that?
It's quite broadly spread. There's a lot more. Well, I guess if you wanted to look at some of the larger brands in China, Gallo, for example, from California, it's impossible to get accurate statistics unless you work for Gallo.
Yeah.
But I would hazard a guess that they're probably importing and distributing something around 150,000 cases or so, maybe more, maybe a couple of hundred thousand. But something like that would be virtually the largest volume brand in China today. Very, very low value per bottle. You're talking, you know, the Carlo Rossi type wines. Other big brands would be things like Concitoro, certainly, which we represent, would be one of the larger brands. The DBR, Rothschild, Lafite Rothschild products that we work with in aggregate, that also would be a very large set of branded wines in the context of mainland China. And there would be others. But a large brand in China today, you know, 50,000 cases, 100,000 cases, that would be a very substantial brand presence for a branded bottled wine in China today. In global terms, that's not big.
Yeah, it's pretty
tiny. Quite small. And so it's very fragmented. The volume is spread across quite a wide number of brands and categories and products. The market is dominated by France and Australia. We've seen a surge in volume from both countries.
I've seen a lot of Australian sort of branded wines at the cheaper end of the price point anyway.
Yes, there are. And I think there's a lot of new sort of buyer's own brand stuff being done as well in the last 2 years. You mentioned Felton Road earlier on.
Yeah.
You know, some of those sorts of wines, although they, you know, they may be very successful mid-range brands in a UK market, for example, in China today, that's very boutique. And quite niche.
I wouldn't say Felton Road and a boutique producer,
mm.
but Okay, so that people wouldn't have necessarily have an awareness of that. Where do people get their information about the wine? Because in the UK, you know, you've got Jancis Robinson and a plethora of wine writers and critics. Mm. In America, you've got, you know, Wine Spectator, Advocate, all that sort of stuff. What about in China itself? Is there a leading critic or a group of critics that sort of steer the way, or are they taking their lead from overseas markets? What's driving the critic mark?
There hasn't been really up until now. There's a few, but not really. The primary source for information and learning and knowledge is the importers and distributors themselves, who have been always very active, and, you know, whether that's through tastings or events or various other forms of marketing and promotion, they really have been the front line in educating initially the trade to create kind of a double front line, if you like, who can then inform consumers. But overlaying that, we start to see more and more people coming into the trade, some wine writers, Chinese wine writers based in China writing, who might have online blogs, and other journalists who might be writing for print media. But it's all still very, very much in the early stages. And I think there are major opportunities to develop these sorts of communication platforms to help to inform the Chinese drinkers about brands, to develop awareness, to develop appreciation. And when you stop and think, you know, that the market has rapidly in 10 years gone from 220,000 cases to more than 10 million cases of imported bottled wines, and then you've probably got about 60 million or more of domestic product, that it's reached that size with very little information and a very immature wine writing fraternity and wine media to support it. What's going to happen when you start to get a lot of, you know, celebrities emerging, you know, sommeliers of note, wine writers of note, wine critics of note, and a lot more talk and coverage and press surrounding the wine industry, a lot more magazines, you know, that the market is very clearly going to become very substantial.
Do you think that's what's driving this sort of bipolar approach with, you know, very high-end wines and very low-end wines and very little in the middle because no one knows about it? You know, there's no real way for people to learn about those wines.
Sure. I mean, I think in very simple terms, if you're a Chinese wine drinker and you don't know much about wine, but somehow you've heard from somewhere that good wine comes from France, so you're confronted with a supermarket shelf or a wine list, you might want to spend 400 RMB on a bottle of wine, you know, and when you look down the list, you're going to go with what you feel is a safe bet or what you're comfortable with, also what you think your friends are going to appreciate. And it's a safe bet if you're buying Bordeaux from France. Okay, you know about wine, you know, sort of thing. It's much higher risk, and you perhaps don't give or receive the same amount of face at this stage if you're buying a wine from Argentina. You know, so there's those sorts of dynamics. And yeah, what's going to change that? It's going to be education. And that's going to be a multi-decade process. And gradually there's going to be a lot of upside for some of these other categories. But right now, today, it's very, very concentrated. As I said earlier, you know, France and Australia dominate. Those two categories alone are around 60 to 60% plus or minus of the total volume going into China, and even more of the value going into China. So,
where do people learn about wine in China?
Primarily the main point of contact is at the point of sale. So in a supermarket, it could be a tasting station, or it could be information on the back of the bottle, or promotions that are taking place in a store. In a restaurant, it's going to be tasting notes in the wine list, or tabletop promotions, or wine tasting events that importers and distributors may conduct. Wine dinners, there's a lot of wine dinners going on, a lot of promotional activity in the market. So that's where most of the education is happening. There are some wine educators who have started to become active, people such as Simon Tam, who invested into China a couple of years ago and is starting to do events and activities up there. You know, the more that these sorts of people come into play, then the more it will accelerate. Wine writers, etc. You know, we've heard that Decanter magazine, for example, have been endeavouring to get into China for some time. Not there yet, but you know, when they do, you know, that's certainly going to be a very important contribution as well.
All right, then, Brendan, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Chris. Appreciate it.
Brendan mentioned Simon Tan at the end of the show. I had a great lunch with Simon and his team on my last day in Hong Kong, and I recorded a couple of shows with Simon on Asian food and wine matching. I'll release these in a few months later on in the year, but next week we're going to be talking with Wendy Chung. She's the Principal Assistant Secretary for the Commerce and Economic Development Bureau of Hong Kong Government. Quite an officious title, I would say. Her role includes policy overview for the wine promotion strategy. So she's the lady to get the government's point of view on the Hong Kong wine market. So we're going to be talking with her next week. How'd you get on with the mystery grape variety, though? It was, of course, Gewurz Traminer. Not too tricky. I think you either know it or you don't, as I said earlier. And Gewurz Traminer is a pink-skinned grape variety that produces a heady-scented, full-bodied white wines. It's cultivated in most parts of the world, particularly in Alsace and France, where it's designated a noble variety. Alsace, normally the grapes come from Germany, strangely enough, but in this case it's actually from Italy, where it's from the village Tramin or Tramonino in Alto Adige. Gewurz is a mutation of Traminer, and it's one of the most common planted variations. Gewurz means spiced in Germany, but in terms of Gewurz Traminer, it actually means perfumed. And that perfume is, of course, lychees, rose petals, and for me, I think it smells a bit like Turkish Delight, which I think some people tell you is rose water anyway, but Turkish Delight is the smell for me. And it's probably easiest to distinguish because of that smell. Although in tastings, I get a lot of people thinking it's Riesling for some reason. Wines from this variety are generally marked by high alcohols and low acids. In actual fact, that's the hallmark of Gewurz Traminer, is those acidity and alcohols. They really do stand out. But because of that, high alcohols, low acidity, works quite well in cool climates where usually getting alcohol up and acidity down is a key problem. So places like Germany, Austria, and more recently New Zealand produce some nice Gewurzes, and I'm going to down a bottle of Cloudy Bay dessert wines later on tonight, which is a Gewurz. And because of that, it's actually quite good at making dessert wines, sweet wines, late harvest. On a negative note, Gewurz is a relatively low and erratic yielder. It's exceedingly prone to viruses and suffers from spring frost. It ripens quite early too and is harvested before Riesling. It's a good quality grape and it's making a reputation with food matching, particularly Asian and Thai cuisines. I'm not quite sure why that is, because high alcohol with spicy food isn't the way to go, but maybe it's that richness and the perfume works probably with some Chinese foods. That pretty much ends the mystery grape variety and the show. The last thing we've got to say is the quote this week, which is a quote which I think is appropriate because of the 2009 Bordeaux en Premier market. And it was said by Thomas Fuller, an English churchman and a historian. Oh, about 17th century, I think it was. And he was referring to a person who drank a bit of wine. He has a hole under his nose that all his money runs into. And I think you need to be careful when you're buying first growths, because that's what happens. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.